Well, hello and welcome to the fifth Tim Masso podcast. I'm so happy to have you with me. Today we're discussing the new 2021 Zenith Chronomaster Sport and looking at it from a historically informed perspective. We're going to compare the new Chronomaster Sport to the 1977 Vacheron Constantin 222 sports watch and discuss the parallels between these two standouts. We're going to discuss indies and major groups, that is, indies, small independent brands, versus groups, and how we distinguish them from each other. It may seem obvious, but it's anything but. Finally, we're going to talk about watch and car co-branding that should happen or should have been. All of that today on the fifth Tim Masso podcast. So let's start with the new Chronomaster Sport. Everyone's talking about this watch. It got a lot of attention almost immediately in a way that almost no Zenith release ever does. Now, I remember back in 2017, possibly the most discussed Zenith release of my lifetime was the Defy El Primero 21, the 1/100th of a second Foudroyant. Gigantic 44mm Hublot-style case, though, to be fair, it was a 1970s Zenith Defy case on a huge scale. The Hublot part was the open dial, and there was a lot of hand-wringing about whether Zenith was going too far in the direction of Hublot and Tag Heuer, the other two Jean-Claude Biver overseen LVMH watch group brands. That watch was also discussed because of the spectacular movement that featured two mainspring barrels, two drivetrains, two separate escapements. And in fact, the two halves of the watch were capable of operating independently, even if the other was not wound. Everyone was on the Defy El Primero 21 because it was spectacular. It had a little bit of controversy surrounding it. It was an attempt to revitalize a brand that seems to need a new comeback every 7 to 8 years. But compared to the Chronomaster Sport, it was like a ripple on a pond. The new Chronomaster Sport, frankly, looks a lot like a Rolex Daytona, and I don't think it's a bad thing to admit that. Zenith was going for that look, and they knew what they were signing up for. There are Zenith cues in there. The pump pushers aren't a Rolex thing, not in the modern era. You've got the overlapping tritone registers, and of course the bezels aren't exactly the same because one's a tack and one is a Foudroyant scale, and the lugs themselves are different. But right down to the clasp itself, the new Chronomaster Sport is very similar to the Rolex Daytona. So the question becomes, can a watch that's born of an outside influence ever assume its own identity? Can it ever take on its own persona and author a legacy that's independent of the watch that inspired it? And I believe it really can. And in order to discuss how this is possible, we need to turn back the clock and venture from Leloque and Zenith headquarters to Geneva and Vacheron Constantin. The 70s were the era of the integrated bracelet sports watch. I know, given recent events, it may seem this is the era of the integrated bracelet sports watch, but the genesis of the type was very much in the late 60s. And the first watch that really put all of those ingredients together, the integrated bracelet, the lugs that flow into the links, the all-of-a-piece bracelet-like ultra-luxury sports watch, it might be the King Midas from Rolex of 1964, but if we consider that to have been a dress watch, then it's likely the first watch in the modern integrated bracelet full-size paradigm was the 1970 Beta 21-powered Rolex Reference 5100. And this watch was designed by Gerald Genta. Now, it wasn't announced at the time, and nowhere on the Rolex website or Rolex headquarters in Geneva will you find acknowledgement of Genta's creation of the 5100. But aside from the fact that it is literally the spit and image of his later work for IWC, Audemars Piguet, and Patek, there is the simple fact that word eventually gets through the grapevine, and in over 50 years, it's amazing what can float to the surface. So, Genta did design the Rolex Beta 21 5100, the first ever Rolex quartz watch. Now, in 1972, 2 years later, he went way up market and turned back the clock to mechanical watchmaking with Audemars Piguet, a timepiece that in its day cost as much as a nice car. The Reference 5402 Royal Oak, the original jumbo, was a revelation in its time, and while it staggered slightly out of the gate, as AP struggled to justify a precious metal price on a steel watch, it proved to be immensely influential even in its time, as by 1976, Gerald Genda himself was ready with variations on the same basic design for the Ingenieur SL, the reference 1832 at IWC, and the Patek Philippe Nautilus Jumbo 3700. Now, right there, we can realize that just because a watch is derivative doesn't mean it's destined to live in the shadow of its predecessor. Absolutely no one looks down on the Nautilus because it borrows the best elements from the Royal Oak. Nor does anyone who's an IWC fan detract from the greatness of the Jumbo Ingenieur or the Ingenieur SL, because it clearly borrows from its other two brethren of the same designer, the Royal Oak and the Nautilus. All of those watches are considered to be classics, and yet all of those watches, with the exception of the Royal Oak, are somewhat derivative of each other. But even the Royal Oak, if we look at the Rolex 5100, borrows the same basic scheme of a hard geometry about the case, a shaped bezel, an integrated bracelet, and all of a piece look. So really, every single one of those famous Genta sports watches in steel from the 70s is a bit of a knockoff, if you will, if you want to use harsh language, of the Rolex 5100, which was the true watch of that era. But it was a watch that came after all of them, that had nothing to do with Gerald Genta, other than the passing resemblance, that is most applicable to today's parallel from Zenith. And that watch is the Vacheron 222, a sports watch created by a company that had almost no history of making them. The 222 was, true to its name, a 222nd birthday present from Vacheron to itself. Of course, Vacheron, then as now, the oldest continuously operating watchmaker in Switzerland, and it's fascinating to note that Vacheron back then had no qualms about creating an integrated bracelet steel sports watch in the style of the AP, the Patek Philippe, and the IWC. It was Jörg Heisick, a young Jörg Heisick, and on one of his first ever commissions, who actually designed the 222, but because of the period in which it was designed and its sheer resemblance to the IWC, the Patek, and the AP, because of this reason, for years, people thought Gerald Genta designed the 222. So it doesn't get any more similar than that, when you can literally pass for the designer's own work. But everyone loves the 222, and Vacheron, in 2019, even paraded its historic museum example of the 222 around the world at venues like Watches and Wonders, proudly showcasing it alongside the modern iterations of the Vacheron sports watch paradigm, the Overseas Generations 1, 2, and 3. And VC happily positioned the 222 in a position of pride at the Watches and Wonders Miami event that I attended, showcasing it alongside the Overseas, which of course came into being from 1996 forward. So you can truly create a legacy that's unique, individual, all your own, and worthwhile without being a completely original design. So I don't think it is slating in any way the new Zenith Chronomaster Sport to compare it to the Rolex Daytona. Now, I think it would be incorrect to say that because Zenith once provided movements to Rolex, that Zenith somehow has a right to those designs in perpetuity. I think the design was Rolex, the movement was Zenith, and never the twain shall meet, with the exception of this new Chronomaster. But this Chronomaster is really keying off the 2016 to present steel ceramic Daytona, not so much the 16520 with the 90s. The new Chronomaster is an outstanding watch. First of all, the price. At $9,500 on a strap, which you'll note you can't get on a steel Daytona, or $10,000 on a bracelet, it's undercutting the Rolex by thousands of dollars. The Rolex is $13,150 in steel on a bracelet, and the same Zenith is $10,000. So on a pricing basis alone, it's quite appealing. But the Zenith very much becomes its own watch due to the same reason every Zenith ever made, with few exceptions, has been exceptional. And that is the movement. The new caliber 3600 El Primero is the El Primero 2 that we've been awaiting since, frankly, 1969. A longer power reserve, hacking seconds, and the arrival, I should say, in a mainstream Zenith of the striking 10th complication, originally introduced back in 2011. This is very much its own watch, and as with almost every great zenith, the heart and soul of the watch, the movement, is what gives it its unique identity. There's a lot of Rolex design language externally, but not so much that Rolex itself is going to make an attempt in court. Rather, you have to come to terms with this watch by taking a long view. If Vacheron's 222 could go from a spur-of-the-moment revision of Gerald Genta design language suitable for Vacheron, and then become a true collectible legend, the thing that Vacheron loves so much that it parades out, trots out with its latest watches, and proudly acclaims as its own, I think in a world where the 222 now stands shoulder to shoulder with the Nautilus and the Royal Oak and the Jumbo Ingenieur, I believe we will eventually see the Zenith Chronomaster Sport be considered more of a peer than a derivative of the Daytona. Even if the design language intent is obvious, the watch has a chance to create an outstanding legacy, partly due to what's inside, but also due to the passion of Zenith collectors who have an enormous love for the brand that has nothing to do with celebrity ambassadors or household name prominence. That's Rolex. That's not Zenith. Zenith lives in the heart and the soul of the true watch nerd, and I think that's where this Chronomaster Sport will achieve greatness. Now, talking about indies and group brands, I think it's important to note that there are independent watch brands that the indies, the Laurent Ferriers, the Chapecs, the F.P. Journes of the world don't consider to be independent. So let's define an independent watch brand as they would define themselves. Keep in mind that Patek Philippe likes to brag about its independence, and it should. The temptation to sell must have been immense for the Stern family, given that Patek is a 1 billion Swiss franc a year business. I have to imagine that a buyout at several times annual earnings would make the Sterns wealthy in perpetuity, but they choose to hold on to the brand, and good on them for doing so. But I'm not sure a billion-dollar business can truly be called an independent brand when a sole practitioner like Philippe Dufour is also an independent brand. Rolex, it's worth remembering, is technically independent, whereas Patek Philippe is roughly $1.5 billion a year, Rolex is roughly $5.2 billion, and it has 4,000 employees. So we need a definition of independence that doesn't bring billion-dollar companies into the frame. They may be independent of non-watch group parentage. LVMH, after all, makes most of its money with accessories and leather goods. And let's not forget that Kering, which owns Ulysse Nardin and Gerard Perregaux, probably devotes all of 2 hours a year to thinking of its watch brands at the executive level. Rolex, AP, and of course Patek Philippe are certainly watch-focused, but immense. However, an indie, as they would define themselves, tends to be a company building fewer than 10,000 watches a year that is, at least in part, independently owned relative to the large groups. They may have a stake, the large groups may have a stake in the indies, but they don't control them outright. So when I went to Watch Time LA in 2019 in May, I spoke to some of the independent brand chiefs who were present, and this term indies is one they created themselves to refer to themselves. And again, it's independence of large groups, volume that ranges from 6 watches a year up to just under 10,000, and ultimately, the watch brands themselves have to be relatively new, youthful, in the sense that they haven't been around since the mid-20th century or the 19th century. So some of the indies would include H. Moser & C. of Schaffhausen with its 1,500 watches a year, F.P. Journe of Geneva with its 650 to 950 watches a year, Laurent Ferrier with its 170 to 200 watches a year, or even a brand as large as Richard Mille, which makes approximately 5,000 to 5,500 watches a year. All of these fit the definition of the indies, And I think you can see in spirit and substance, they are quite different than something like a Rolex, a Patek Philippe, or an Audemars Piguet, where the employees number between the hundreds and thousands, and annual revenues would be impressive for a mid-sized car maker. So these indies truly are smaller in scale and deserve to be discussed differently than those which are merely not owned by Richemont, Swatch, or Kering. One could also make the case that Seiko Epson belongs in that discussion, as Seiko Epson, under the enormous Seiko group, is technically independent, but at the same time, a multi-billion-dollar company. Now, I also think it's important to recognize that with these indies, almost all of them are 1985 foundation or newer. Remember, it was back in 1986 that the AHCI, which is sort of the cool kids club of independent watchmakers, was jointly founded by Vincent Calabrese, Sven de Andersen, and Bernard Lederer. And from that seed, we saw the arrival first of small white label independent watch development engineering houses like THA under Vianney Halter and F.P. Jorn and Denis Flageolet, as well as the work, for example, Carrie Vulin and Philippe Dufour were doing sort of in the background and out of sight for the large brands. Michel Parmigiani was getting his start in restoration during this period, and it was ultimately his restoration work for the Sandoz family, a pharmaceutical magnate family in Switzerland, that ultimately brought him to watchmaking under his own name. So at the end of the day, it's not just enough to be small and independent. It's also almost necessary to be new. As when we talk about the indies, the newest ones in general are Andersen Genève, founded in the 80s, F.P. Jorn, Montrejorn, founded in 1999, Richard Mille the same year, Erwerk, founded in 1997. And this is the scene that we call the indies today. They are the carré des horlogères at SIHH, the independent brands at which you can expect to have a first name basis relationship with your watchmaker or brand CEO. I also think, now that we've established what indies are, it might be fun to discuss car and watch co-brandings that haven't been, but probably should have been. And I'll start with an indie, with an American slant. Have you ever wondered what kind of car would be associated with a Devin watch? I had to put a lot of thought into this, and out of the gate, I wasn't sure, because there are a couple of independent American car makers. There's Panos of Georgia, there's Shelby Supercars, there's the rebranded and reborn Saleen under Steve Saleen, and of course, there's Karma in Southern California, and Tesla, the electric car upstart in Northern California. And even though Devin watches are made in SoCal, I feel like they're ideally a match for Tesla, because in so many ways, they were created by industry outsiders. Elon Musk was not part of the auto industry, and a lot of the people he brought in to found Tesla in the early days, he was not actually a founder of Tesla. Guys like Martin Eberhard actually created the company in its earliest days, but obviously Musk became the face and the driving force behind the brand. But if there's anything he holds in contempt, it's traditional automaking, even the most enlightened forms of traditional automaking. When Tesla employees tried to implement the Toyota system on the assembly line at Tesla, and remember, the Toyota system has worked from Japan all the way to Stuttgart, where Porsche adopted it, Musk reacted violently. He screamed, he yelled, he carried on, he tossed all the parts that had been stacked in regimented stations alongside the assembly line. He tore up the Kanbans and the notes and the assembly instructions that people had laid out for their peers. Everything that went into collaborative and efficient operation at Toyota pissed Musk off. So this is to give you an idea of just how anti-car industry he was. And at Devin, they initially had this notion that they would create a watch that would use a belt display, and they would go to Switzerland and they would find a company that could design this white label and allow them to brand it. And ultimately, everyone rebuffed them, either saying they didn't want to work with these American upstarts, or they didn't want to share their technology with non-Swiss companies, or they flat out couldn't do what was being asked because they didn't know how. And as a result, Devin wound up drawing more from American aerospace parts suppliers than it did from the traditional watch industry. Things like the belts that are used came from the aviation industry, as they were used in the analog displays of old 20th century aircraft. Components came from the medical devices industry. Medical devices can't drop dead on the job, so they need to have endurance but also precision. And that is where the electronic micro stepper motors for the Devon Tread and Devon Tread 2 were found. And slowly but surely, they put together parts that they found in other industries from specialist suppliers that had nothing to do with watches. And when they finally rolled out the Devon Tread 1 back in 2010, yes, they earned a GPHG concept watch nod, a nomination from the Swiss, but more than that, they did it independent of the traditional watch industry. And that's before we get into the electronics, the microchips and microprocessors that power the Devon watches, the use of lithium-ion batteries. That almost makes the Tesla comparison too easy. But I think it's the spirit and the upstart American ingenuity of these brands, more than the fact that they're both electric products, that make Tesla and Devon a perfect match. Now, of course, Scott Devon is a car guy. He originally created the Devon GTX, based on the Dodge Viper drivetrain and chassis, and he planned to buy the Viper factory out of Chrysler's bankruptcy in the late 2000s and then build the Devon GTX in the old Viper plant. Well, Chrysler wouldn't sell him the factory as a standalone, so he decided if he couldn't make cars, he was going to go into watches. Shortly thereafter, Tesla declared its intent to build what was then called the White Star, a mass-market sedan following its Lotus-built Roadster that would put Tesla on the map as a real car company. And of course, that became the original Model S. And I feel like the Devon Tread 1 or 2 and the Tesla, any Tesla, are just a match made in California heaven. Or highway heaven, perhaps we should say. Now, let's talk about a matchup that probably shouldn't have happened. And that's Bentley and Breitling. I like them individually as brands, even though neither one is really my style. But I feel like Bentley is something that is almost unattainable. It's not just aspirational, it's exorbitant, it's over the top, it's brash. It drips with luxury and exclusivity. When even the cheapest Bentley is going to run you $150,000 to $200,000, no Bentley can be described as affordable. Whereas Breitling has a little bit of a democratized luxury factor, especially with the Sellita-assembled and Sellita-powered Breitling watches. You're really talking about a very accessible watch that you can pick up for well under $4,000. And while that's not cheap in the global scheme of consumer goods, by the standards of the luxury watch industry, you know, that's your Starbucks habit every day, traded for a watch a year. So Breitling is perhaps a little bit too accessible and mass market to be convincingly paired with Bentley. I like them both, but I see Bentley as something more along the lines of Grubel-Forsey. And in fact, the pricing scheme is remarkably parallel. In order to get into a Bentley Continental GT, you're going to be paying approximately the entry-level price of a steel Grubel-Forsey. You're probably not getting into your Bentley after options and delivery costs for less than $200,000. And Grubel's entry-level watches are priced just below $200,000. The volume is low. The price is exorbitant. The finishing by hand is uncompromising. And while it's true that if you're paying less than $400,000 for your Bentley, it's probably Volkswagen-based, the fact remains that the brand image and status and stature are a better match for Grubel and the way Grubel does things than they are for Breitling. Now, let's think about Omega, because while Omega has released car-themed watches in the past, and the 2018 CK2998 pulsometer chronograph was one of them, it is rare for Omega to get on board with a car brand explicitly. They did so in 2017 with the Gray Side of the Moon Porsche Club of America 99-piece limited edition. But if Omega as a brand were to embrace a car company, what would it be? So I decided to hitch Omega to a similar mass market luxury brand, also based out of continental Europe, that I think is ideal in character, and that's BMW. Yes, I know Ball Watch already created a partnership with BMW. It never really got off the ground in terms of collector buy-in and popularity, but it existed nonetheless, and they're nice watches. Nevertheless, I think that Omega and BMW, both representing innovative mass market luxury, are a better match than BMW and Ball. First, Ball has the American angle, and while BMW does have a number of American factories, I always think of BMW as German to the core. Omega is a perfect match because, like BMW, which is known to do occasionally crazy things, like the C1 motor scooter with a roof, or the i8 hybrid supercar, or the full carbon fiber frame i3 commuter car, Omega also does crazy things that, for example, Rolex would never do. Skeleton watches, hand-finished watches with display case backs, tourbillon watches. Omega has absolutely no qualms. Omega thinks that nothing is taboo and will embrace any concept if it can do it well. Quartz watches, you better believe it. The X33s, some of the finest in the business. Ultra-high mech, like the tourbillon, absolutely no reservations. How about something that's a little bit wacky, like the Apollo 8 with its moonscape dial? Omega's willing to do that, and just like BMW, is willing to do things that are crazier than, say, Audi or Mercedes-Benz. Omega has that same kind of joie de vivre, that sense of adventure, and the willingness to do something that might bomb outright. Omega has created a shaped watch jump hour with a salmon dial. That was the great DeVille jump hour of the late 90s. Omega has done collaborations in all but name. Remember the Tintin? Well, it's not just a nickname. That was literally supposed to be a Tintin co-branded chronograph. Omega has that BMW spirit that drove the original M cars, like the E24 M6, the original mid-engine BMW M1, and the E30 M3. Omega has that same kind of raw-edged ambition on some of its watches that take no prisoners and make no apologies. And again, I'm really thinking about the Apollo 8 here as the best example. Or, for that matter, the 2003 Jacques Mayol Apnea Chronograph, a watch built for free drivers at a time when free diving was on no one's radar. Doing something like that that's cool and soulful and really true, and not just to the name of the celebrity who endorses it, but to the vision of that person. This is Omega, and Omega and BMW, that's a match that has to happen someday. If you're asking Mercedes-Benz, Tim, what is their match made in heaven? I actually think Benz is Rolex. It's a standard. It's not necessarily the ultimate, but it is the fixed point against which all others in the segment are judged. Mercedes-Benz, what defines it? It's the S-Class. And every time someone describes a Lexus LS or a BMW 7 Series or an Audi A8, inevitably they say, it's the Audi version of a Mercedes S-Class, or it's BMW's S-Class competitor. It's never the other way around. Mercedes has always been the point of reference, whether we're talking about diesel-powered taxicabs in Angola or S-Class pulling up to a Bilderberg meeting. That's what Mercedes-Benz is. And when you envision that Bilderberg pulling up in his Mercedes, you imagine a Rolex on his wrist. Now, what else can I say? Well, I would say that all things considered, car and watch co-brandings are a lot of fun because at the end of the day, the car stays at the curb, but the watch goes into the boardroom, the dining room, and the bedroom. The watch can't take you places, but the car can whisk you away. Road tripping with a cool car and a cool watch is a small piece of heaven. And I think that more than anything is why people who are gearheads love both, because each one in its own way offers a unique experience while appealing to the same part of our hearts and our heads. So, to bring everything full circle, if F.P. Journe were a car brand, or co-branded with a car brand, what would be its match? And I had to think about this because it's truly difficult. I don't want to say something mainstream because F.P. Journe, love him or hate him, goes his own way. And he is unrepentant about that. He is a man who controls every single detail from the shape of the hands to the placement of the indices to the layout of the dial to the shape of the clasp and even the material the movement is made of. His volume is low, his clientele is elite, and there's an esprit de corps amongst those who collect Jorn watches. So I have to say that Horatio Pagani and Pagani Automobiles would be the ideal match for F.P. Jorn watches. Now, I remember when Pagani, as an industrial designer and an engineer, first started talking about building a car in his own name in the late 90s. And it was originally going to be called the Fangio, and it was going to be built in the memory of Fangio. His panache, his courage, his style, and his legend. And it was only at the last minute that the decision was made to call the eventual Pagani car the Zonda. And if you look at the uncompromising and sometimes idiosyncratic way the cars are styled inside and out, the fact that Pagani is not just interested in putting his name on the product, nor is he just interested in the intricacies of pushrod suspension and stressed carbon fiber monocoque chassis. No, he's interested in the glint of the chrome on the dashboard, in hand-stitched leather unlike anything this side of Britain. He's interested in avant-garde interior design, as crazy as anything you'll find this side of a Spyker. So when Horatio Pagani envisions a car, he envisions a car the way F.P. Jorn envisions a watch. Get the hell away from me, back off, wait till I'm finished. And when this is complete, all of you engineers and designers and production folks who work for me, you're going to realize my vision as I envisioned it. I'm going to take no prisoners. It's my way or the highway. And the car that reaches the client is going to represent my undilute imagination. And the client is either going to agree with my vision and opt in, or he's going to be revolted and opt out. I'm not making any concessions. I'm not changing the product, and I'm not going to compromise at any point in the process. If the car costs $3 million after I take every part as I specify it, add them up, and then place a profit margin on the end, so be it. And that's how F.P. Jorn has built his watches. That is what it means to be an indie, whether you're making a car or a watch. Thanks so much, guys. This has been the fifth Tim Masso podcast. I'll be with you next week. Enjoy the weekend. Time out, Tim out, and thanks for logging on.